Welcome to the Two Cities Podcast, a podcast about theology, culture, and discipleship. And this is episode 215. In this episode, we're talking about Pivot with Dr. Scott McKnight and Laura Barringer. Dr. Scott McKnight is professor of New Testament at Northern University, and Laura is an author and a kindergarten teacher. Team members on the episode from the two cities include Dr. John Anthony Dunn and me, Dr. Madison Pierce. So, John, what were some of the things that struck you in this episode?
Yeah, I really enjoyed this conversation with both Scott and Laura about their new book, Pivot, which, you know, builds upon the work that they did in Tove and applies that content more specifically with practical advice and tips and tricks and things to implement and do in order to bring about a church culture that is more tov-like or good from the Hebrew word for good, tov. I just really enjoyed it. I think that it's a really tough conversation, and they bring up a lot of sad stories, but they do bring up some really redemptive stories as well. And I just appreciated both how they've provided this great tool to be helpful, and also kind of like to help people improve their church culture, but also to identify toxic elements in church spaces as well.
Yeah, I totally agree. Having read Tove a couple of years ago, it does paint a vision for a beautiful church. But this goes so many steps further. And so it's such a valuable resource. I mean, I think I say like 17 times in the episode, but I really do mean it every time. So I loved hearing them reflect on their different stories. But I think that Scott, toward the end of the episode, talking about or responding to your question about deconstruction, was the real gold in the episode. So I really appreciated that and felt really hopeful. If you haven't already, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a review. And you can follow us on X, Facebook, Instagram, or visit us at our website at thetwocities.com. And with that, here's our conversation with Dr. Scott McKnight and Laura Barringer. Laura, Scott, thank you so much for joining us. It's great to be with you.
Good to be with you.
Thank you for having us.
Oh, of course. Well, so you are something of a dream team, a father-daughter duo, and this is your second book. So could you tell us a little bit about the first project and then tell us about this new book?
Wow, where do we even start?
Well, I'll start with this. I did not want to write Tove. I was busy thinking about the book of Revelation. And Laura was a total pest.
Yeah, that's the short story. I was a pest, and that's how we
came. She kept saying, Dad, you got to write about this. Dad, I said, no. And then a publisher actually came to me and asked me to write about Willow Creek. And I said, I'm not a sociologist or a church historian. They're not going to let me have access to their records. So I blew them off. I said, no. And then I was reading. Well, Laura kept saying stuff to me. And then I had a couple blog posts that did pretty well if you're looking at numbers and impact. And I was reading a book on German pastors responding to the Holocaust after it was over. And I couldn't believe the parallels between how pastors deflected responsibility and how I was seeing this with the Catholic priests, the Southern Baptist pastors, and Bill Hybels. So I started taking notes, and we were on vacation together. And I said to Laura, I think I have an idea for a book. And it became the false narratives chapter of the things we saw. Yeah, so that's where it started. So actually, I had put Laura off, and I think she'd kind of given up on the idea until at Christmas we were in Mexico or wherever it's called, Cancun or something. And I said, I think we have an idea. So we started at that point.
It all really started with the Willow Creek story, that becoming public was personal for us because we knew some of the women. And it was really disorienting because we would read in the Chicago Tribune statements by the church that the women were lying, they were colluding to take Bill Hybels down before he retired. And it didn't entirely make sense, but I was naive to church scandals at the time. And I thought, well, Willow wouldn't lie, but we also knew the women wouldn't lie. And so there was a really horrible realization at one point when I thought, oh my gosh, one of the sides is lying. And who, it's disturbing either way. And it's not the women. So
I remember saying to you, there's no way that Nancy Ortberg is lying. Yeah. And Mark knew Vonda Dyer and said, there's no way Vonda's lying. And all of a sudden you're going,
well, and we thought, Nancy's lying.
Yeah, Nancy Beach isn't lying. So
yeah,
someone else was. And that's what turned the tide for so many people. Yeah. Oh, it's sad. It's sad. And Madison and John, we have dealt with probably 200, 250 stories like this.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And the number of pastors who tell the truth is under 10.
Wow.
I mean, it's really sad. Is the people who preach forgiveness of sins upon confession are the ones who don't want to confess their sin. How's that for a depressing note?
Yeah, that's pretty sad. And I think that's really representative of what some of the dynamics that y'all are exploring in Tove, which is such a valuable book. I've needed it at a couple of different points in my life, and I was very thankful for it. But Pivot is the next part. So yes. That's, you know, it's kind of saying Tove is not the whole story. So how did Pivot come to be? And tell us a little bit about it.
That was a nice pivot, Madison.
Nice pivot. Thank you, John.
Pivot!
So, you know, in the months after Tove came out, and people had time to digest it, and we got unprecedented, but for me, it was unexpected because this was the first book that I had written, A Church Called Tove with my dad. We got a lot of interest in that book, and we were getting a lot of requests for webinars and interviews, and it really struck a chord at the time because it was shortly after Willow Creek and Harvest. You know, those were just the tip of the iceberg. So people had time to digest it, and we were frequently invited to these events and interviews, and people started to ask us, well, what can we do? So you paint this picture of Tove, and we want to have a culture of goodness. How do we do that? And that question became more and more frequent as months and years went by. And so did others. There were a few others that rose to the surface. People wanted to know, you know, what red flags should we look for? People wanted to know, like, a lot of people that contacted us are lay people, and they want to know, I'm not a leader, I'm not on the leadership team, but is there anything that I can do? And so those questions just never went away. And so we attempted to answer them, and that ultimately became Pivot.
And it is, it's such a valuable resource because it answers, I mean, these are questions that y'all outline in the introduction, you know, how do I transform things? How do I identify them and all of that? And the book is such a helpful resource there. So let's dig into some of that. So what are some of the ways that we might identify an unhealthy culture?
Well, one of the things, you know, Laura and I can answer both questions usually because, you know, we wrote the book together. But one of the things that was really valuable to us, I'll say it this. I was teaching a class, and a student at the back, there's a D-Min class, and the student at the back, after I'm talking about Tove for a while, says something like this: you've got all the right ideas, but you're using the wrong words. And I said, well, what do you mean? He said, I did a PhD in organizational transformation. And he said, I know quite a bit about this, and you're talking about the right things, but we use completely different terms. And so he said, you need to read Edgar Schein. So now this is the name Schein is the perfect German spelling of it as well. So I read this book and I finished it. And then I think I bought a copy and had it sent to Laura's house. One of the key things was the realization. He uses a pond as his illustration. The pond has a culture, has a dynamic that all starts in the thought, whatever, the soil at the bottom. And so Laura and I played with this and we came up with the idea of a tree. And this is the big idea that's so important to us, is that there is a culture in every church, in every institution, that is invisible and it is below the ground. And it takes expertise to figure out what that culture is. And people who are living in it do not see it. So Edgar Schein, like he's pretty big, MIT. This is like the fifth edition of his book. And this has made him famous. He'll go to IBM. I mean, he'll go to the main businesses and he'll camp out in those places 3, 4, 5, 6 months before he can discover the invisible characteristics that are actually driving the institution. So what we did is, of course, we can't get into every church's institution. And I'll let Laura describe the tree that we used. I thought the easiest way for us is to look at the manifestations of the flesh, and then in the tree, the fruit of the spirit. It's just people resonate with biblical stuff. So that was a very important place for us to start. And so I'll leave it to Laura to tell you about her sick tree.
Oh, so, you know, we picked a tree and so we made it metaphorical, but it's all research based. It's all based on this research by Schein, who's the leading researcher on organizational culture. And I believe we picked a tree because of the passage in the Gospels where Jesus talks about producing good fruit. So then we landed on a peach tree because I have one in my backyard. And I thought, oh, well, this is perfect for this illustration because my peach tree is very unhealthy. We've had it, we planted it, my husband and I planted it 10 years when we moved in. We've never eaten one peach. But what we've learned, though, is that, you know, the problem is not like the tiny green peaches that the squirrels carry off or the squirrels or the dead branches. The problem is that we're not properly caring for the soil of the tree. And that kind of that, that's the metaphor that we wrote about in Pivot, that the culture, what people see and experience are your peaches. Like when people walk into your, if it's a church or organization or nonprofit, the visible elements of the culture are what people see and experience. And they might be able to walk away and identify like, oh, those were, you know, they passed the peace and those were friendly people if it's an Anglican church or whatnot. But what is hidden is under the soil, is under the tree in the soil. And that is really what determines the health of the culture. And so my dad did the theology for this, but our big question is, what's in your soil? What is feeding your tree? Is it fleshly toxic fruit or is it tove? And we've seen examples of tove and we thank God for that. And we've also seen too many examples of toxicity in the soil feeding the health of the tree.
And one of the things that all of us now know is that things driving churches, when there's, you begin to notice some toxic fruit, you think stuff's going on here. Well, things that are driving behind the scenes that are never admitted but are really drivers are things like ambition, glory and fame and competition. You know, they want to have the biggest church, abusive power, greed, consumerism, measured by numbers. These are things that drive churches. And when these pastors and leaders in these churches give public talks on big platforms, they never talk about these things. But those are the things that if a sociologist was at that church for 6 months, would say, you know, you people live on competition rather than, let's say, following Jesus. You know, they, those aren't the things that are driving them. So we're quite keen on recognizing some of these things. And I saw something on an email. I got an email the other day and I sent it to Laura.
Dad, that's all I can think about while you're talking is I got really riled. I read it. So I read the title yesterday. I had a really busy day. And then this morning I read a little bit more and I could not get past. Let me back up. The people listening are probably like, what are you even talking about? Without naming names, or we can name names. I don't know. There was a blog post by a former executive pastor who left his position and is now, he started like a consulting business and he consults with churches. And I don't want to say anymore because I don't want to say the wrong information, but it's like he helps churches. He goes in and helps them get better at what they do. And I think he especially works with executive pastors. So initially I was like, I don't even know how I feel anymore about an executive pastor. You know, so set that aside. But the opening paragraph or quickly at the top was all about if you want your church to be successful, ... And I was like, wait a second. That's not what a church should be about, being successful. That's feeding a toxic culture. And I think it really, I think it was really startling to me. I thought, well, this is not to sound dramatic, but it's dangerous because I don't know how many clients this person has. What if he has a lot of clients? He's got a lot of followers on Twitter or X. Like, what if a lot of people are listening, a lot of pastors and churches are listening to what he's saying and could potentially have a lot of influence on forming cultures that are driven by looking successful? That's toxic.
Mm-hmm. Some of the things that y'all are naming are really important because a lot of times when people think abuse or toxic, they think some really heinous stuff. And so it's black and white. Like, this is obviously abuse because somebody was harmed physically, somebody was this or that or whatever. But what y'all are identifying is that there is a broader range. And so we don't have to stay here too long because I know you could probably spend the rest of the podcast identifying different forms of harm. But what are some of the lines for y'all? Are there things that you are able to identify, like when it crosses this threshold? Or maybe you could talk a little bit about the Tove tool.
Well, every one of these, I mean, okay, I'm talking to a pastor today who is a major leader of a denomination, and he had to get rid of someone's, he had to ask a pastor to turn in his credentials. And he said to me, why is this happening? All of it? Why? We have a pandemic about this. And I said, we've changed everything from a pastor to a platform performer whose job is to bring people into a church and sit there and pay money so that the business can go on. And what I've learned, Madison, I think you know this, and that is people who are really good on platforms are really good at persuasion. And they know what they can do and get by with and what they can't. You know, if you go to work as a pastor and you take out a baseball bat and you break your desk and then you break someone else's desk and then you hit the associate pastor on the backside, you know, nobody's going to question that. But where does grooming start? Where did it go just over the line to where someone said, I'm not so sure that's right? But they weren't convinced that it was totally wrong because they thought the person was a pretty good person. But all of a sudden they thought, I'm not so sure I'm comfortable with that. This is where I think these perpetrators in churches, Christian institutions, however you want to call it, this is where they dwell very successfully for a long time before they get caught. And I think that there are ways to draw lines, like if someone has too much power, if they have too much privacy, if they have using fear, if they are violent in verbally with people, things have to stop right there. But it's so hard for people in these churches. I mean, we knew people at Willow Creek who said, yeah, we saw things, but there were so many things that were successful. We didn't want to muck up the glory of God that was happening. And so I wish I could say these are the lines to watch, but they're usually require someone with moral discernment in the moment. And we need safe places for people to be able to tell their stories so that someone with discerning moral capabilities could say, we got a concern here. We got to deal with this.
And I'm sure with both of the books, you know, there are probably plenty of stories of people reading them and thinking about the church culture that they are a part of and recognizing that it's toxic. And they could do a couple of things with that. They could, of course, decide to go to a different church that's hopefully healthier, or maybe they, you know, deconstruct and recognize layers of spiritual trauma and you know, ditch the church, or at least have some difficulty sort of staying associated with Christianity. And I'm sure you've heard plenty of stories along those lines. I'm curious, have you all heard, you know, redemptive stories of people who are in these toxic church environments that are able to make them tov, that are able to make them more tov, perhaps maybe not completely tov, if that's an eschatological aspiration, perhaps. But is there are there some stories that you could tell us, even without full details of how churches have gone from toxic to tov, rather than people just leaving their toxic churches for more tov-like churches?
I think my favorite one, we wrote about in the book, the story of Oak Hills Church. That one is just became so meaningful to me. I think because the pastors had, in this, you know, day and age, from what we've been hearing, they had such like vulnerability and willingness to look at themselves and who they had become. And they said they felt uncomfortable with termed it runaway ambition. This is a church out in California that underwent a transformation process. But they said it started with reflection on themselves, on their own character. And they felt like, you know, I feel really important standing here. And after a service, people are in line waiting to talk to me. And Willow Creek knows me and they call me an up and coming leader. And they realize, like, wait a second, this isn't right. And they started reflecting on, they had been reading Dallas Willard and Eugene Peterson. And they started reflecting on those teachings and they said, our attractional model of church actually was working against Christ's invitation for authentic transformation. And so they took out what was toxic in their soil. They took out success, which I was mentioning before. They stopped count. Success was no longer a goal. They did not count how many people came. They took out ambition. They took out the attractional model completely. They said the people coming to church had become consumers, and they just every week they wanted like an even better show. And they replaced that soil with the fruits of the Spirit. They replaced it with discipleship, and they pushed it. People were completely confused, by the way. The staff had been hired for their talent and their skill. They were completely lost and confused. The attendance dropped, but they said in the end, it was worth it. They just kept pushing and pushing against the culture, and they transformed. They completely transformed the culture of that church into something that was good. And more importantly, like, they surrendered to the Spirit and followed where he was leading, and their lives were transformed as well.
You know, that's a great story about Mike Lucan and Kent Carlson. It is really quite a story. And I read their book when it came out, but when we started writing this, I said, this is the story we need. And so I sent it to Laura. So she loved reading the book. So
I love that.
She remembers more of it than now. Than
Renovation of the church.
Yeah. Now here's something, John, that to answer your question for me, here's some terms that came to mind. Recognition of a problem. That is not automatic. Because they might say, oh, we just got to fix this. It could be really deep and they got to explore it. So we developed a TOG tool for this. Second is a process. You have to go through a process. And that process is going to take time. You can't do a sermon series on TOG and turn a church into TOG unless you're Charles Spurgeon and you hit magic on one sermon that changes everybody. That doesn't happen very often. And people ought to give up the idea that it can happen. So you have to develop a strategy, and it's going to be an adaptable strategy that takes a lot of process. There is going to be liminality. There's going to be times when you're entering into an area and you don't know what's going to happen, and you don't know if it's good or it's bad, but you're going to explore because this is going to be new turf. You're cutting down trees you've never seen before, and you don't know what's going to happen. Another thing is tension. There's going to be people who don't like the process, and they're going to leave, and they could be some of your favorite people. And it's not that necessarily that they're mad. It's that they just see things differently, and they say, I don't want to go to a church. Most people come to church to sit and to listen and then to say hi to people and then go home and have dinner and watch the Bears lose. But they did beat the Minnesota Vikings, so I just thought I would bring that up.
What a bad game.
I'm a 49ers fan. It's okay with me.
They can't beat the 49ers. But they leave. This is the culture of churches today. That's not if that's going to be what you're going to do, you're probably going to create the same kind of problem. And then it's going to take time. One of the stunning results, something that we confronted in this book, as that we learn from these people who do organizational transformation, is that when an organization is committed to change, it takes 7 years. 7 years to change a culture. Cultures form, and they are so thick and strong and invisible that you don't even know they're there. And to change that culture requires just as much time and work as it took to get it there. And it might take 10 years. And that's when people want to be a part of it. And you know, the easiest way is to kick out everybody who doesn't want to participate in that change. But most people don't want to leave their church that way because their friends are in church. And plus, they teach Sunday school or they sing in the choir. They like singing in the choir. If they go to another church, nobody's going to pay attention to their voice.
The research on culture is so interesting. David Brooks is one of my favorite, but he talks about how culture actually tells people how to behave, how to respond, what choices to make, verbal, nonverbal. When the boss makes a decision, how to process the decision. So it's fascinating, and it's also equally strong. And like my dad said, you can't see it.
Oh, I mean, okay, whistleblowing is a major issue. Okay. I've spent way too much time reading about this and paying attention to this idea of whistleblowing. But people don't want to whistleblow because it doesn't do any good. And it causes pain. And so there's a thing called learned helplessness. Well, that learned helplessness is from a culture. There's a culture at work that created that. Now, how are you going to change that? You don't say, well, I'm going to tell the truth. Well, yeah. And then you lose your job or you lose your status or it's really, really painful. All right. So what do? You can fight, and it takes it's a rare bird who can continue to peck on the house that doesn't have any wood in it, you know, but they just keep pecking away. And it takes a long time, but it takes a lot of courage. And that's why Laura and I, we consider whistleblowers heroes, because they had the courage to step forward and probably suffered more for whistleblowing than they originally suffered to begin with. But that's a culture. The learned helplessness is a culture that has to be resisted. I cannot tell you the number of people that Laura and Laura's talked to a lot of people I don't know anything about, but that we've talked to in the last 3-4 years that have basically given up on being able to do anything about the situation. So
we got a long note today, Dad. It came in from our website from some whistleblowers. Story, yeah, I sent it to you. Every story is so painful to read. It is not easy to be a whistleblower.
Yeah, that's a really important note. And I appreciate it. I'd love to hear y'all talk a little bit more about transformation agents, which I think is an important concept throughout the book. But I did want to make a note that at the time of recording, our recent stories about some whistleblowers that were quote unquote successful in being able to remove, you know, a faculty member at a university for sexual misconduct. And, you know, you think about all the institutions that were able to not be accountable and not hold him accountable for his actions, and who took him down? The Instagrammers. And so it's still, that doesn't mean that it was an easy fought battle or that there isn't a lot of harm that took place in that situation, but there's a lot of courage. And it is interesting to see these new mediums play roles in these horrible situations.
And from what I've read, that university did a really nice job responding and believing and acting on what they learned.
Yeah.
I'd like to know if people had gone to proper authorities within the institution, if they responded properly there, or did it take the social media that puts heat on a place?
Pressure.
So I don't know. And I'm happy when the truth happens. As I said, there are very few pastors who admit what they've done. Very few leaders who admit, you know, if people write me, what should I do? I say, tell the truth. Just tell the truth. It'll do so much good. Just tell the truth. Admit it.
That's so good. Yeah. So some of the stories that you focused on, the Oak Hills story, and then some of the other things that you were talking about, Scott, those do focus on, you know, top-down change.
Yeah.
But so often, the identification of a toxic culture of a problem isn't coming from the top, but it is coming from one of these transformation agents. So could you tell us a little bit more about what that looks like, even beyond, you know, somebody blows a whistle, and then what happens next?
Well, Madison, this is one of the most discouraging parts of this whole process of writing both Tove and Pivot. And that is, for instance, a pastor, I'm sitting in a class and a pastor says to me, if someone wants to change the church, just tell them to leave. And it was a candid, honest, truthful statement that if they're not in a position of leadership, it's you know, you're pushing against, you don't have the power to make it happen. So, and he was a transformation agent himself in his church, and it was dramatic what happened at his church. But one of the things that we have to deal with on a regular basis are people who are powerless in a church who have genuinely recognized a problem. And they are up against City Hall. And what can they do? And to be honest with you, I'm pretty realistic with people about this. You know, your chances of serious transformation are pretty low, but it's worth the fight. But have a strategy. And I always say this, the first thing, you know, you got to be in a healed position to be able to come forward as a whistleblower or a complainer. Yeah, all right.
That's good.
Okay. The second thing is, or at least pretty healthy and have a lot of friends around you who can help you. The second thing is, I think you need to recognize you need to use the policies and procedures for whistleblowing at that institution as much as possible. Mm-hmm. Because if you go outside that, they can get you for all kinds of things and it won't work. Now, I do not believe that whistleblowing policies in churches and Christian institutions are foolproof and or safe. They just aren't. So it's you need to know what you're getting into. So someone called me not that long ago and said, so-and-so is going to be complaining. What would you tell them? I would say, be ready for a lot of blowback, and it's going to be painful, and it's probably not going to work, but you got to try. So use the procedures as much as possible. And then third, I would say, strive to be heard. Don't strive to change, strive to be heard. See if you can just get your idea on the table where you think, these people at least have heard me. Because most of the time, they pretend like they've heard you, and they haven't. And then fourth, give yourself time, a time limit. You know, I'm going to do this for a year, and if it doesn't change, I've got to leave. And then realize that leaving is going to put you in a liminal space where it's going to be painful. You're going to miss your friends. You're going to miss your church. You're going to miss the ministries that you were participating in. And it's really hard to start in a new church. So that's pretty realistic, but I think that's how it happens.
Yeah, that aligns with the advice that I give. You know, I've people approach me as well because I'm open about some of the situations that I've experienced in my past. And every time I share the story publicly, I have people contact me about their own situations. I have students, and yeah, the first thing I tell them is if you're going to tell your story because you want justice, then we need to keep talking. But if you want to tell your story because you want to tell the truth and you want to honor what's happened to you, let's keep talking. And it's a hard thing for them to hear, but it's so important. And I'm talking to Past Madison there too, because I fought a lot of battles that I had no hope of winning. And it's a good thing to manage the expectations.
Yeah. That's good. Very good. Well, we also have, there are situations where churches in the leadership, they realize we've got some problems. And so I developed sort of a process for transformation agents of what they need to do. And it's a lot more work than most people realize and plan on a 7-year process rather than a 6-month process. But I believe that it needs to be not the senior pastor, not the people who have the most power, because then it's too mixed up. It's like, you've got the power to fire me and you're asking, and I'm trying to ask you to change, or I'm trying to ask the city, I see a problem and now you can fire me. So I really believe it needs to be surrendered. And I realize this is probably foolish and reckless, but I believe it's true, is that I just don't think most pastors would surrender power of transformation to someone else. But then I think they have to develop a theology of what they want. So this is Bible. Study the Bible in a small group with some people and listen to what other people have to say. Build a consensus of people who see a vision for the Church of Tove, then expand that group a little bit and then keep listening. This is not a top-down thing. This is a real grassroots level of a group of people who are listening to one another and coming up with a vision and a strategy for what the church can do, then expand it. I talked to one pastor who worked in with, he worked actually with a couple people, and I wish it hadn't been the pastor, but it was. And then it was a few more people, and then eventually got to the leaders in the group, and it was a pretty big group. And it took 5 years before they went to the church, the congregation, with the changes. By then, they had built a mass of people who were fully committed to this. And wow, it was an effective transformation of the church. I'm not saying that they were perfect or anything like that, and they're not, but still, that's the kind of transformation agent. But I really believe it has to be away from the senior pastor at some level. Someone else has to manage it so that the senior pastor's ego is not running the show. So, all right. Mm-hmm. I tried to answer that question. It's a tough one.
That was good. So it strikes me. So in our series, this is our pivot. We have been looking at so many different forms of harm, sources and experiences that people have. And we're turning in a different direction. But our conversation has been very candid and realistic so far. So as y'all look and think about this sort of vision for what churches can do to transform, what are some of the things that have given you hope? Or if that's a pie in the sky sort of question, then it's okay if we can't quite go there.
I've had glimpses. I don't have necessarily concrete answers, but my glimpses have been the number of people that want to talk about this topic. The church planters are really exciting to me. We've had the privilege of being on a few church planter podcasts or speaking with those who are planning churches. And that's really exciting to me because they are building a culture from the ground up, and they have the opportunity to develop their soil before it's toxic or Tove, and they can intentionally cultivate it. That's exciting to me that they're the number of church planters that are interested in developing healthy culture. And something else that comes to mind, I spoke recently at Julie Roy's, it's called the Restore Conference. And I had somebody come up to me at the conference and say, "We made a packet of Tove. Like, we have one. We made our packet of Tove." And that really like made my heart leap, is that's when you have people that aren't in power, that they don't have influence on decision-making. They're not in any sort of leadership circle, but they still have their own agency and did what they could to create a pocket and live Tovely within it. And a fun story, they named, somebody had a baby in the pocket of Tove and they named him Tove.
Oh, really? The baby's name is Tove. That's good.
So good.
And there's a church, not too far from where Madison teaches called Tove. There's a little church.
Yeah. Oh,
yeah. We've seen, someone sent us a picture of it.
It's okay, become quite a catchy little word.
Yeah. I saw somebody's got a Instagram called Theology of Tove. And
look what you started, Deb. Now all of us know one Hebrew word.
All right. Okay. Here's the thing. All right. There are a lot of good churches in the world. And those churches give me hope. And because a Tove church constrains people in the direction of Tove. The second thing is the Holy Spirit is very powerful.
Yes.
All right. Now, one of my students who works with spiritual formation said, it's really discouraging to see how church people behave when you believe that they have the Spirit in them. All right. So I recognize that, but the Spirit is powerful. Grace, God's grace, can forgive us of our sins and work in our lives. And there's the power of the resurrection the gospel of resurrection can talk about new life coming beyond the grave. And then, of course, there's stories of individual transformation that we see that individual people can change. I'm 70 years old. It's not so easy anymore. But we see a lot of people, you'd like to see them change a whole lot more than they have. But these things are glimpses, as Laura said, little pockets of Tov occurring in churches and in communities and among people that you say, this is a glimpse of Tov. Mm-hmm. So instead of, I like to think that we got to give up the idea that the whole church is going to be transformed and just practice Tov in our little circles of people and see if we can make a difference in those circles and then live with that. That's what we got to start with.
Yeah, I appreciate it. There's a line towards the end of the book where it talks about systemic problems. Or there's a myth that systemic problems need systemic solutions or something like that.
Yeah.
And that's where you're kind of busting that myth with the idea of having these like little pockets.
Yeah.
So I really appreciated that.
Let me say it. This is a really important idea to me. And I don't know why people don't listen to me on this. And that is, I hear this all the time. Systemic problems deserve systemic solutions. Yes. But systemic problems did not start because of a system. They started because of little decisions of individuals made over time that created a system. It's not like you take out your hard drive and swap a new hard drive and now you've got a new computer. It's that hard drive has to be rebuilt. So the old hard drive has to be rebuilt. And to do that is going to take a lot of people making the right kinds of decisions that will build over time a different culture. So it's not, I agree that it has to be a systemic solution, but to get that solution requires a lot of time at a very small micro Tov moments.
Well, yeah, that's a helpful clarification. I think what I'm recognizing in some of your answers, and then as I'm kind of processing what I've experienced in the last few years in the reception of the book, the first book and everything, is I think it really matters that people are engaging more with these conversations and that they're raising their awareness that, I mean, especially Gen Z, they're so much more aware of mental health and their personal kind of alignment and attunement and everything. And then you add into that some of the resources that you've put together. So I wonder, when people are approaching you and telling you that they've read the book, are they picking up on things and making connections? Is that another source of encouragement?
It's how Pivot came to be. Is people kept saying, you know, well, how do we do that? Like, how do we form a culture of goodness? And initially, you know, we wrote a church called Tov, and then months and months go by before it actually is out in the wild. And I had gone back to teaching, you know, I was like, people would ask that, and I'd have this like moment where I think, I don't know how you make a culture into one of goodness. You know, don't these people know that I was like making kindergarten back to school ready confetti earlier today? Like, I don't know. But I graduated from that, you know, like my dad's had books shipped to my house and we did a lot of research, and we've had the opportunity to talk to a lot of people, hundreds of people, many of them who are actually doing this work. And that's how Pivot came to be. And it is encouraging to know that people want goodness. I love that question. We were on a podcast recently, and the podcaster asked you, Sheila, she asked you, like, what is the gospel? Like, people want more. They don't just want, I just want to get out of hell. they're like, they're wanting more. They're wanting goodness.
I've gotten three letters in the last two or three days of people who read Tove or Pivot and said, you told me exactly what I was looking for. You put into words what I didn't know I had experienced. So we get quite a bit of affirmation for Tove, calling out stuff. People like to hear that because they participate vicariously in calling out toxicities. Mm-hmm. But they're looking for solutions. A person in a church, they're right now in the process of entering into confronting a pastor. And the book has been really helpful for preparing them for what they're going to have to do. And it's going to be difficult. And I told her that it's going to be difficult. It's encouraging. But I have to tell you, this has been 4 years of listening to, you know, if you were Lutheran, I could use a stronger word here.
Oh, you can say whatever you want. We don't censor. We don't censor.
We've listened to a lot of shit about churches. Okay.
I believe it.
Okay. I mean, and it's, you know, after a while you just say, I've had enough of this. I don't want to hear anymore.
Yeah.
And then the next day you get an email and we feel empathy and sympathy for these people. It's so difficult. And you can feel their pain in their stories. But I do have to say, so many people have been helped by this book. And I'm glad that Laura was a real pest and tried to get me to write about this, because I thought the Revelation book was far more important.
I'm glad you had such a good idea, Dad.
Well, it seems apropos that the Revelation book would be something you'd be working on at the same time, because there is that kind of, you know, aspirational, this is what we're living in light of this future vision, right? And I am curious, you know, what would you say to the person who's been disillusioned by church as a result of the types of toxicities that you both describe in your books? Somebody who believes that the church can never be Tove as a result of what they've experienced.
Well, I have a book at the publisher right now with a student on deconstruction. And I wanted to call it The Prophetic Voice of Deconstruction, but the publisher didn't like that. It's going to be called Invisible Jesus. All right. Here's what I would say. I want to hear their story, and I want to say your story is probably right. Okay. I understand why you don't want to go to church, and I don't blame you for not wanting to go to church. I love your hopes for a church being Tove. That's what we should strive for. But human people are sinners, and it's not going to be perfect, and we're going to have to deal with that. But I believe that the people who are deconstructing and calling out problems in the church are some of the most prophetic voices the church is going to hear today. And we need to listen, and they're not a problem. They are a problem for power, but they are not the problem. And I'm glad that they're speaking up, and they are recognizing look, this pastor today tells me we have a pandemic of pastoral problems, that he had to pull a pastor's ordination. Okay. Why is there a pandemic? That's what these deconstructors are actually talking about. This is going on. Why is this going on in the church? I read the Gospels and I think that's not what Jesus wants of his people. Now tell me why we've got this kind of stuff. And when they criticize the church for those things, I say, you're right. So I don't know if I answered your question, but I thought my answer was pretty good.
It was great.
It was pretty Tove.
Yeah.
Well, I'm curious too, since you have two books out now, can we expect a third? Will there be a Return of the Jedi to complete this trilogy? Perhaps nine marks of the Tovely church or something along those lines?
We'll see what Laura comes up with next.
I've caught the writing bug. I just wish I had more time.
Yeah. I do. I am also going to start pretty soon with a student who is a trauma therapist on marks of a trauma sensitive church.
Ooh, okay. That's
so good. So Laura Anderson's book is out now, When Religion Hurts You. It is a really good book. Mm-hmm. We want to write a little bit simpler form, and just here's the things churches need to start working on to form in their culture. But it's not a follow up to Tobe. These are two pretty special books that we were fortunate to write, and to say at the right time some of the right things that needed a follow up with Pivot. And I think that project is over. Laura can now write about beagles and kindergartners.
I'll definitely read those books too. Oh my. Well, we usually end with a kind of last question, but I feel like that's a really good place to wrap. And so rather than asking one more, I'm just going to make one final plea for our listeners to go and read A Church Called Tove and Pivot, because whether you're leading a church, whether you're in a church and you think it's good or you're not so sure, it can always be improved and become more Tove. And so it's really, really excellent resources. So Scott, Laura, it's always a pleasure. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.